Well, the man said, we're gonna start it off. We're gonna start it off. We're gonna start it off. And then he said, we're gonna start it off. We're gonna start it off. We're gonna start it off.
Episode number 8 of Becoming Who We Are. I am your host, Cody Stopper, and I am definitely excited to share this interview with you today that we have. I'm interviewing Gene Anderson, Reverend Gene Anderson. His story is compelling, it's interesting, he has a lot to share from his journey that I couldn't edit because it was all so good. It was one of my funnest interviews to date. It's probably my funnest interview to date. He did a tremendous job sharing his journey with us. He was diagnosed with bipolar, and he is wrestling through and journeying through what all that means, and he has, of course, his ups and his downs and twists and turns all along, and he shares a little bit of that with us, and I think you're going to get a lot of enjoyment out of what he has to offer. So I'm going to cut right to it because I couldn't edit out very much. So I hope you enjoy episode number 8 of Becoming Who We Are and Reverend Gene Anderson. So Gene, man, tell me a little bit about yourself. You can give me a brief.
My name is Gene. I live in Florida, in Ocala. It's not my hometown. I was raised, actually born in Germany, and adopted by, you know, an American serviceman and his wife, and born in Heidelberg, and came back to the States when I was, I don't know, about a year and a half old. And my mom was from Ocala, born and raised. So when we settled here after my dad got out of the Army, I guess I was not quite 10. So it's my hometown, but yet it's actually not, because by the time I got here, I'd been to Europe a couple times, lived in California, Colorado, Georgia, you know, Army brat, travel around every 2-3 years. And I got to admit, it's kind of funny. I'm sitting here right now. I'm reading an ebook of The Wisdom of Stability by Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove to write a review for Inglewood Review of Books. And of course, we'll look at the title, Wisdom of Stability. And I'm sitting here thinking about all the moving I did when I was a kid.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, I've wanted to read that book. Do you like it so far?
It's really good. I'm in the first chapter. I think I've read about maybe 20 pages. It's really good. I've heard a couple of podcasts with him, and I was really looking forward to reading this. And I read his first book, God's Economy, and it was awesome. So, yeah, this is a really great book. He talks a lot about the monastic tradition, because, you know, he's into neo-monasticism, and last year, I was telling a friend of mine recently, with everything I was going through, that other than reading the Word, when I'm really in a bad situation, I go to the monastics and the Catholic mystics. So I read like Saint John of the Cross and Thomas Merton and Brother Lawrence and Thomas a Kempis, and so these are the Desert Fathers, and that's the kind of people that he's really referring back to in the book. So I can tell I'm going to really, really enjoy this book. And actually, being bipolar right now, I'm going to enjoy writing the review in my blog, because I guess a book entitled Wisdom of Stability is probably a pretty interesting title when you're bipolar.
Yeah, no kidding, man.
Somehow it will tie in, I'm sure. You know?
How long have you been diagnosed with being bipolar?
Officially diagnosed would have been, let's see, this is 2011, and I went to Mississippi to pastor at a little church there in, I think it was like November 2008. So it was the first week of May 2009 was when I actually went to a psychiatrist, had the appointment, talked with him, and you know, and he says, here's what you got, here's what you got to take, here's what you got to do. And so I guess basically, what's that, 2019, not quite 2 years ago. But I sort of knew, you know, I had been to some different counselors and stuff, and had people basically say to me, even friends, you know, maybe 15 years ago, 20 years ago, well, here's what I think's going on with you. And I'm like, well, thank you for your opinion. You know, that and a buck will get you a cup of coffee. But so I kind of knew when this psychiatrist told me what going on about 2 years ago, I wasn't, I guess I wasn't surprised, might be the word. In fact, I remember when we were talking, kind of saying to him something along the line of, so, hey doc, you know, am I totally nuts? I mean, am I out of it? And he's like, no, you know, here's what you got. And, you know, a certain percentage of the population have it. And actually yours is quite manageable. You know, you're going to have to take a couple of pills every day for the rest of your life. But so actually it was kind of a relief. And, you know, I think, it's a relief when you find out something. I mean, it sucks to find out something's wrong with you mentally or physically. But yet at the same time, you know, you got these symptoms, you got something going on. Maybe it's physical. You have, you know, certain physical symptoms that are bothering you, or you have certain mental issues, emotional issues that are bothering you. And at least when you find out what it is and what the treatment is, that's a relief. That's a relief. Although I have to say, I remember I was just sharing with someone, a friend of mine on Twitter, who recently has been diagnosed with basically the same thing. And they have started a blog, something like I did. And I sent her a note of encouragement on her blog last night because she was speaking about this, what she calls shame. And it's that once you're diagnosed with something and you go out and you're in public, you're thinking, oh, wow, like I'm the crazy person in the room. You know, I heard a comedian, I don't remember who it was, but they were talking about when you go to your family reunion or you go to, you know, Thanksgiving with the family, you always have like that crazy uncle or the eccentric aunt. And so you have that crazy person in the family. And if you go to the reunion and you can't spot them, you're it. You know, I forget, maybe it was Chris Rock or somebody. I can't remember now, but it was some comedian some years ago said this. And you know, and it's kind of like that, but she was referring to this feeling. And I told her about the day I was diagnosed. I was in southern Mississippi, a little north of Hattiesburg, and had made an appointment for this psychiatrist who once a week had a practice in Hattiesburg, but his regular practice was down in Gulfport, which was maybe a 2-hour drive south to the coast. I had called and made an appointment. And it was going to be like about a week and a half till I could get in Hattiesburg. So I called him back and I said, if I go down to Gulfport, can I get in sooner? And he says, yeah, you can come down in about, I was like 2 or 3 days. So that morning I get up, I have this wonderful drive down to Gulfport, but I got, you know, like 2 hours to, I'm going to a psychiatrist's office. I've never been in a psychiatrist's office. I've been to a therapist. I went to a psychologist for my ordination psychological profile. But this is a psychiatrist. This is like, you know, the crazy doctor, you know. So I go in the office, and the first thing I do, I sit down in the waiting room, and there was 2 or 3 people in there. And, you know, I'm not trying to look down on anybody, but I'm sitting there thinking, like, I don't want to chat with anybody in the room because I'm thinking, okay, these are crazy people I'm sitting with. And then I'm thinking, I'm sitting with them. I'm a crazy person. You have all these things, at least I did, all these things going on in my head. Fill out all the forms. You got to answer a million questions, you know, from insurance to, you know, did you wet the bed as a child, or, you know, what, how much do you drink in a week? All these survey questions. So then I go into the office. I talk with him about an hour, and he says, okay, I've got 2 prescriptions for you. We're going to start you on Prozac. We're going to start you on Lamictal. He tells me about them and, you know, whatever. So then there's a Walgreens up the street, I don't know, maybe 2 blocks. So I drive over there. And what I shared with her was when I went in to get my prescription the first time. I've never had to take any prescription medications on a daily basis in my life for anything. So here I am realizing I have now entered the ranks of how many, you know, people in the world that every day have to take a pill, whether it's for high blood pressure, depression, whatever. So I go in there and I give them my prescription at the pharmacist. And I wanted to crawl under a chair and hide. I remember I had to go to the bathroom. I went to the men's room. Like, I didn't want to come out. for 15 minutes till the prescription was filled, because I'm thinking, well, this pharmacist person knows what different pills do. So he's seeing my prescription, and he's going, oh, this is like the crazy guy in Walgreens. I mean, this is what I'm thinking. I just wanted to hide. I'm thinking, I'm nuts. So I get the prescriptions, and I went out to my truck, and I got in the truck, and one was in a package, one was in a bottle. And I pulled them out of a little bag, and I had them in my hand, and I'm looking at them. And I remember I just, like, cried for, like, 10 minutes or something. I'm not a crier, although when you come on to Prozac, it will, especially with guys, it will make you have crying spells. I'm kind of getting close to that point now, I think. And it goes for a few weeks. But I remember, like, crying, thinking, what I described to her was that I felt like I had just lost a battle. I had just surrendered to the enemy. Like, I give up. In reality, what I told her last night is I had just begun to fight. But I remember thinking to myself, I have to take these pills every day for the rest of my life. I can't do it on my own. I'm really, something's wrong, and I actually have to take these pills and go see this guy. And there was a guy and a woman. I'd go to the psychiatrist, and then I'd go to the therapist, and I have to do this, or I'm not normal. I can't cope. And so the next day, I was going to start my pills, and I remember I didn't do it. I waited 2 days. The next day, I went to take them, and I thought, the first time I take, you know, I take one in the morning, one in the evening, I have to do it every day, ever after. And I just wasn't ready for that. So I waited 2 days, and then 2 days later, I took it, and I remember, it's funny, I kind of remember taking my first Prozac that morning 2 days later and kind of thinking of the scene in The Matrix. Or was it taking the – he took the red pill. I think it's where you take the red pill to go. And it's sort of like that. I was like, okay, well, here I go down the rabbit hole. Let's see what happens. What's interesting is I guess it was a few weeks later, I was at my psychiatrist, and I asked him, how am I going to feel these pills taking effect? And he said, it's like watching grass grow. You can sit, you watch, you don't see the grass grow, but if you go out after a couple weeks, you know, the grass is higher. And a couple weeks later, he asked me what I had been doing for like relaxation time. And I said, well, I got this carport and this big backyard behind my house, and there's a little step, a couple steps that goes down from the carport into the backyard, and I've been sitting there watching the grass grow. And he laughed. He said, well, I didn't mean to do it literally. But he thought that was pretty neat. You know, I said, yeah, I spend about a half hour, and I watch the grass grow every evening while the sun is going down. And he was quite right. You don't per se notice the difference. It's not like, say, you're taking a tranquilizer, like you're taking a Xanax. Let me tell you, if you take a Xanax, if you're anxious, you take a Xanny bar, you'll know when it hits you, you know, definitely. But it's not like that. It's not like that at all. It's a friend of mine on Twitter mentioned to me a few days ago. She said, I can tell the difference in you. I've been taking about 2.5 weeks now. So I'm right at that point where it starts having a real effect, but it'll really be like another month until it shows. I still, the way bipolar and depression, I have type 2, which is the type where you're basically depressed. I do have manic episodes, but they're not what they call type 1. That's the one where sometimes people have to be institutionalized. They tend to be manic. That's the one, the stories of God told me to take off all my clothes, run down the street, go to the bank, pull all my money out of the ATM, and go to the dog track because my lucky numbers are in. Wow. That's maybe exaggerated, but it's that kind of mania. And it's very dangerous. Very dangerous. People can be very hurt. Mm-hmm. The depression is dangerous too, in that, well, you might commit suicide. Mm-hmm. But I'm more the type 2, the primarily depressed. And I can see my behavior change, although I still go through periods. The other night, I was writing something about this last night on the blog. My dad's car broke down. I've been using my dad's car recently. Yeah. And he came over on Sunday for dinner, and I was taking him home, and the alternator went out. Mm-hmm. And luckily, I got him back to the assisted living. It was a long drive. The car dies as soon as I drop him off. Oh, wow. And So I mentioned in my blog that I cussed a little bit, had a couple cigarettes, said some vile comments against the Hyundai Motor Company, and then called the tow truck, and we got it to the mechanic. When I got home, I was using my roommate's computer, and the batteries in the remote mouse died. And all I'm thinking at that point is, I used my dad's car, and it broke. I'm using the computer, and it broke. And the next thing I know, I'm back in this kind of depressed mode, like, oh my God. Of course, bad things had to happen because I just moved into a nice place and I'm getting some job leads. And so, of course, something horrible has to happen because some real good things have just happened. And of course, I'm not a good person. You know, when you're depressed, you have a negative view of yourself. Well, I'm not a good person, so really God's setting me up for the big fall because really I'm not lovable. And really it's like a big, you know, God's the song by Depeche Mode, the old song, Blasphemous Rumors. What is it? I don't want to start any blasphemous rumors, but I really think God's got a sick sense of humor. And when I die, I know I'll find him laughing. It's that kind of thing, you know? And so then my roommate, she gets up and, oh, it's just the batteries in the mouse, you know? And I'm feeling like a complete idiot at this point. I'm sort of pacing around the house. I was actually on the verge of almost crying. Prozac will put you into crying spells, I found out. When I first took it, I didn't know this. And I had just gone through a major breakup in my life, huge, at the time I started my pills. They coincided. And my wife moved out. She left on a Saturday. The next Sunday I had to preach. The very next day I had to preach. The Sunday after that was Mother's Day, and the Sunday after that was her birthday. And those were the first 3 weeks I was on my pills.
Wow.
And it got to where I remember one Sunday preaching, and I brought up the issue of you know, kids in Africa and safe drinking water and these, you know, these children that die of hunger and whatnot. And it's a sad topic.
Yeah.
The next thing I know, I'm about to start blubbering in the pulpit.
Oh, wow.
And I think it was like 3 Sundays in a row, any little thing, I wanted to start crying. We were talking on the phone, she and I, and the least little thing, I would just go into a crying spell that could last 45 minutes. Mm. Or, I remember, let's see, what was it? Well, I'm just saying, I could just cry at the drop of a hat, and it was so unnerving because, you know, guys, boys don't cry. And so it was really tough, and I went to my psychiatrist, and I was like, look, man, am I going to cry like this, like, the rest of my life? And he's like, no, you'll get through it. What it is that women exhibit what's called the classic signs of depression. The not getting things done, all the, you know, the depression symptoms. Men, especially with more of a type A personality, along with those symptoms, will tend to exhibit anger because what they do is displace their sadness with anger. I'm angry that I'm sad. So instead of owning the feeling of sadness about something, they'll take on anger. It could be really violent anger, or it can be a more less of a form, you know, not going and punching a hole in the wall or hitting someone, but anger nonetheless. When you start taking the Prozac and whatnot, as I understand it, you start owning those feelings. So when you are sad, you feel sad. You don't get it. You don't say, oh, I can't feel sad. I'm a guy, so I'm going to get angry, or I'm going to, you know, whatever. I'm going to brood. No, you feel sad. So I felt very sad in my sermon about these children in Africa that don't have safe drinking water. And the next thing I know, I'm like crying in the pulpit in front of everybody. And then I remember after church, it's a little country church, and everyone would take off, and I'm sitting in my office. And a lot of times I wouldn't go home right away. There was nobody at home, nothing in the house. So why go home? And I'd sit in the office, and for just no real reason, I could just be sitting in my office after church and just have a crying spell. And it just drove me nuts because we're not talking 5 minutes. We're talking 30 minutes. We're talking 45 minutes. I can almost cry myself to sleep like when you're a little kid. That really freaked me out. I was raised in a military family, and in my life, I've been a cook, all these things. You know, just boys don't cry. You know, it's not like that. And you get through that once you balance out. But it's this time going through starting my pills, I am I'm kind of expecting these things. I kind of know what to expect.
Prepared a little bit.
Right. The first time, you know, my psychiatrist, he let me know the things, what to expect, but it's different when you've gone through it, obviously. It's different, you know. I guess it's like being an astronaut shot into space. You know, they can train you and tell you what it's like to be in that space shuttle when it goes up. It's going to vibrate. You're going to feel the whole thing's falling apart. You're going to have the G's you pull. And you can even simulate all of that. But the first time you go up in space, it's an original experience. Now, when you fly the space shuttle again a few years later, you know what to expect. You know what all those feelings are going to be. So I guess it's something like that, like any experience in life. The first time is original, and after that, you kind of know what to expect.
Right, you're a little bit ready for it. So.
Yeah, pretty much.
But even though you're ready, I mean, it's still going to be tough.
Well, this has been a different experience for me this time, because what happened, I resigned from the church basically a year ago. It was in February. I became official in April, but it was actually 1 year ago, right now, was when it was really going on. My father got very, very ill. He has cancer, and he was in a really bad situation, and he had to move into assisted living and whatnot. And I came home. I was home for an extended period of time. And basically, while I was home, some of the powers that be at the church decided it was a good time to tell me to resign. Hmm. And so I did. And there was, you know, I had an interview recently with a committee with my denomination here. And one of the things, they smoked me. They just smoked me. Hmm. And one of the problems was, well, you're not owning up to your shortcomings that related to the resignation at this church. And what I didn't want to tell them at the time, I hadn't started my meds yet. I was very, very depressed. And basically, I'd been beating myself up for a year.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, I didn't feel like sitting there talking to 15 people, very successful, with medical insurance that I did not have.
Right.
More or less, you know, suits, beating myself up in front of them. I just wasn't in the mood to do it. So I probably did come across as pointing fingers at everybody else. I just wasn't in the mood that morning to criticize myself. I just wasn't. And I think they saw it a different way, but you know what? That's their problem, to be quite honest. I had been beating myself up for a year. And so I got off my meds. I couldn't get them. I had a psychiatrist in Mississippi. I'd moved back to Florida, so I needed a new psychiatrist. And without insurance, forget it. My psychiatrist out there, I think, was what, maybe $150, $175 an hour, whatever. I was paying $25 on my insurance, so I could afford it. So I have no job, no insurance, and I had to come off my meds. It was basically May, June of last year, and I never want to go through that again, especially being unemployed, living alone. You know, I mean, just my life circumstances were lousy to begin with. Anybody probably would have been depressed. But on top of it, I have bipolar depression on top of it. And the beach saved my life. I'm a beach guy. I was living right across the street from the ocean, this little apartment, and every day I would get up and in the evening and I walked that beach and chat with people there and whatever and just walk the beach. And it was sea turtle nesting season and the sea turtles were nesting. And so I became the monitor, as I felt, of all the sea turtle nesting mounds around where I lived. So I had to get out and go check on those sea turtle mounds every day. That was kind of my thing. That was my coping mechanism, I guess. And the funny thing is I have Dostoevsky on my computer. I have Brothers Karamazov as an audiophile download. And a friend of mine recently asked me, since I didn't have internet, what were you doing with your computer? And I said, every night I listen to Dostoevsky. And he was like, you're depressed and you're listening to Dostoevsky? No wonder you want to kill yourself. And I said, yeah, I know. And also he said I was a real geek. He goes, you're the only guy I know that would actually have Dostoevsky on your computer, that it's not required for school.
Oh, man.
But, you know, in Karamazov, there's the character Father Zosima, the abbot, you know, what they call him, Starets, I think it's Starets, like the holy man in the community. And if you ever have read Karamazov, even though he dies fairly early in the book, he expresses so much life wisdom. Zosima is like one of these literary characters that I wish was real, and I wish I could have met him. He was actually based on a real person. I can't remember the guy's name. But so I listened to the wisdom of Father Zosima every night when I went to bed. But yeah, it's when you think about it, it's pretty twisted. Here, I'm depressed, I'm getting off my meds, and I'm listening to Dostoevsky every night. That's pretty twisted.
You
know? Oh, I probably deserve to be depressed doing that.
You know? No kidding.
Yeah.
You talk about the church a little bit. So you went for a year. Did you, when you were diagnosed, did you tell right away, anyone right away?
Yes.
You? Okay.
Yes, I did. I'm trying to think now. I went to the psychiatrist the Tuesday, one or two Tuesdays before she left. So it might have been that first Sunday after she was gone. It was either that or the next one, but it was very early on. I think it was the day after she left, that Sunday. I don't remember what I preached about. I don't even have the notes from that sermon. I have no memory of what that sermon was about or the text or anything, you know, the scripture text. But what I do remember is I decided that I was going to announce, it wasn't in the sermon, I think it was actually during the announcements period, that I had been diagnosed with type 2 bipolar, primarily depressive, that I had started a regimen of meds, that I was going to be going to psychologist / therapist. At that time it was once a week, then it became every other week after maybe 2 months. And eventually it was just once a month. I'd go and spend 10 minutes with the psychiatrist, answer a few questions, spend an hour with my therapist, go fill my prescriptions. That was it. It was so simple. It's something I want to express to people is if you have a mental illness, once you get diagnosed, maybe not all cases, but for the most part, once they get you on your medication, if you're an outpatient situation, it's really simple in a way. I mean, it wasn't like, and I enjoyed going to my therapist. Mm-hmm. I really did. She was great. Because it's interesting when you're a pastor.
Yeah.
Because not that pastors are therapists, but we do counseling. So
yeah,
we're sort of on the same page with a therapist. And so she and I would have the most interesting discussions. I remember one day I brought in my copy of Drops Like Stars by Rob Bell.
Mm, yes. Mm-hmm.
Just thinking she might enjoy the book. We weren't breaking that boundary, you know, where you don't want to be friends with your therapist, but we had a friendly relationship.
Yeah.
And I remember her saying she took it home, and I actually found out. She told me her father was very ill. And so on a personal level, it helped her. But I remember we were discussing the merits of Drops Like Stars relating to issues that she dealt with people in her therapy. And I had to remind myself, wait a minute, I'm the patient here. I'm not a colleague, you know, but there was that kind of relationship between us. But and I'm plugging Rob Bell there because I can't wait to read his new book.
Yes.
And the more I'm hearing all this talk about his ideas from this new book on the web, and it just makes me want to read the book more.
Right.
So I can't wait for it to get out. But and Rob Bell, if you're hearing this, send me a free copy and I'll review it for you.
that goes for me too, man.
Yeah. But what happened on that Sunday, I announced it from the pulpit. And there were a couple of reasons. One, at that moment, I felt like I was alone in the universe.
Mm.
And when you're a pastor, you know, I remember hearing this in seminary, and it is true. One of my professors told us one day, he says, basically, here's what's going to happen when you go to your church. No matter how grounded you are, no matter how humble you are, and humility is probably not one of my strong points. Humility and patience, you know, say, don't pray for that. Well, I pray for it, and maybe I'm getting a little closer. But he told us, he said, look, no matter how grounded you are, your congregation, or at least elements of it, are going to put you on a pedestal, and it's not there. You're standing on thin air. And when you mess up, it could be something big or small, they're going to knock you off the pedestal they put you on. And when you hit the ground, your butt's going to hurt. And I definitely was on a pedestal. There was a small country church, very conservative. And there were, you know, I was, I remember one Sunday, I didn't wear my robes. I was preaching about kind of the issues of working class people there, something along that line. And so I wore a pair of jeans and a button collar blue shirt, no tie. You know, I looked presentable, but I was not in my, you know, fancy Dan clergy robes. And I had two women in that church that for 6 months never let me forget it. I mean, never. They weren't mean-spirited about it, but every time they got a chance, they would bring up, you weren't wearing your Geneva gown and you weren't wearing your stole and carrying on. But that, so here I am, the guy on the pedestal. I've been there 6 months this Sunday, roughly 6 months. So I'm still very new. And I got up and told them this. And I had been advised by one or two pastor friends of mine that it was like basically pastoral suicide. They were like, do not get up in the pulpit and tell them what's going on. And I said, no, I feel that they need to know this. And frankly, I needed the support. I feel that one of the problems in a lot of churches today is this idea that the pastor's on a pedestal and somehow they're above. They know more, they're more spiritual, they're closer to God, whatever, however it is. And for the sake of pastors, folks in churches don't need to do that. It's bad enough being the pastor in the sense that here you are the shepherd. I don't believe pastors are shepherds. Jesus is the shepherd. Me, I'm just a sheepdog of a particular flock. I'm just a sheepdog, okay? I work for the shepherd. But still, you have these added responsibilities. And then the church puts you on a pedestal, which also isolates you. I was in a very small town and in the rural South, and one of the first things I learned is I didn't have any friends. I mean, you have people you're friendly with. You have folks in your church you're friendly with. You have other pastors you meet and your friends. But yet those are professional and church relationships. It's not like here in my hometown. I'm going to play drums tonight at this pub that it's been around about 15 years. I've been going in and out of that place for 15 years. Some of the guys that cook downtown go there, and I used to cook with them. They're my homies. I mean, they think it's great I'm a pastor, and they might even talk to me about some, you know, something about the Bible during set break. But we're homies. I mean, we've gone through life together. That's a friend. They don't care if I'm washing dishes at the restaurant or I'm the Pope. You know, to them, I'm just Gene. I'm this guy they know. And that's a totally different kind of situation. And so in churches, I wish there was more of the real relationship, the web of relationships, the body of Christ, that kind of thing. And so here I am thinking, I really need ministry. Who pastors the pastor? I need, and it's not simply, hey, my executive presbyter or somebody I know from a minister's prayer breakfast. I need the very people that I'm in the community with in that church that I get together with, and we pray and we do Bible study together and we eat together, and they visit my home and I visit their home. I need them. I can still do my job. I can minister to them, but I need to be ministered to by those people. So it works both ways. The other reason I did it was, and this is an allusion to West Wing. I love West Wing. I shouldn't say this, but I'll be honest. West Wing, Mountain Dew, and a Natty Light and a Whopper with cheese once in a while is what got me through seminary, other than the grace of God. And so I loved West Wing, and I could do a whole sermon series on West Wing episodes. And, of course, I mentioned to this one preacher, I said, well, what happened to President Bartlett when he ran for re-election and he'd been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and he didn't tell anybody? And he's like, I don't know. And I said, he almost lost his election. So I felt that it was responsible of me in a mature, responsible manner to inform my church. And I didn't want to just inform the elders. I wanted, you know, the little old lady that sits in the back and knits during the service. I wanted her to know about it. What was interesting is the reaction. I think there were a few people that they didn't say it, but I think they didn't like the fact that I was seeing a psychiatrist. But by and large, after the service, I had people coming up, hugging me. This was an elderly church. I remember one woman telling me in tears, she's like, you know, I have a son. He's about your age. He's been diagnosed with depression. He self-medicates. He's drinking all the time. He's doing this. He's doing that. He's losing jobs. All the classic signs. Maybe you going through your treatment can be an example to him. Or maybe I'll introduce you to him, and maybe you guys can get to know each other, and you can sort of show him that it's okay. It's okay to have this. It's okay to take the pills. It's okay to go to a psychiatrist. So it was interesting that I was able to actually minister to some people I never met. Wow. But I'll tell you right now, it took a lot of courage to get up in that pulpit say that. I remember to the moment I opened my mouth to say it, It's like that scene in Animal House, you know, where the guy's with the girl and he's got the devil on one side and the angel on the other, and yeah. the angel's saying, don't do it, and the devil's saying, do it, do it. It was like that. Wow. I mean, one side of me is going, don't say this. And the other side is, you have to say this. For your own good and for the good of this community, you have to say it. Hmm. So I did. I'm glad I did.
Yeah. And you went for
real glad I did.
Another year there. Is that right? And then
I was there. Well, it was January of last year. So that was, well, May to January, what, 8, 9 months. Hmm. I came home pretty quickly. My dad was in intensive care. I was going to be home about 3 weeks. He was going to come back with me. I was actually talking with an elder in the church on the phone about that, and then found out one of the other elders was actually meeting with the Committee on Ministry at the same time, wanting my head on a platter, while this other elder is telling us, oh, yeah, let me tell you the doctors your dad can see, and blah, blah, blah. And I found that to be very distasteful.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, I'm not a big fan of church politics.
Yeah.
I grew up in church. And when I went in the Army, when I got out of the Army, I was just a little hellraiser. I was the good church boy in high school. I wore Jesus t-shirts to school. I mean, I had my Bible with me. I gave out Chick Tracts in high school. I was saved reading Chick Tracts. I'm that kid. You know, I was the treasurer in the Bible club. I got out of the Army at 22, and I was a proven seasoned party veteran, you know, and I didn't go to church hardly at all for, I don't know, 15, 18 years. And it was very interesting. What happened is it was kind of my early, mid-30s. I did a lot of reading. I'm a high school dropout, but I sort of self-educated. I, you know, read books and whatnot. Got into poetry and fiction. And I heard about Nikos Kazantzakis, the Greek author. I read Zorba the Greek. I read Zorba. It was a great book. Good movie, too, with Anthony Quinn. But he wrote The Last Temptation of Christ, and I got a hold of the book, and I knew the movie had come out a few years before, and there was all the hoopla about it, because I wanted to read the book. And before I read the book, I thought, well, maybe I should read the Gospels or the New Testament, so I got something to, I can compare and see what all the hubbub is about. So I read one of those little Gideon's New Testaments with Psalms and Proverbs. Then I read Kazantzakis. Then I went back and read the New Testament again, and I was telling my dad about it, and my dad says, What did you get about Jesus after reading the New Testament like twice in, I guess it was within about a year of each other. And I wasn't quite sure what to say. And I looked at him and I said, Dad, Jesus was a rebel. And he looked at me and he says, don't you ever forget it. And when I preached my first sermon at my home church, which is a big steeple First Church here in Ocala, great church, great people there, but here I am preaching the contemporary service. I was a little nervous. My dad's sitting there. And you got to say, my dad, he grew up on a farm in Wisconsin. He's 23 years in the Army. He chews Red Man. I mean, he's not a hippie. He's not, it's not like my dad is, Dennis Hopper, an Easy Rider by any means. He looked at me. I was sitting by him just before I went up, to start the service. And he looks at me and he whispers in my ear and he says, tell me again, what was Jesus? I looked at him, I said, a rebel. And he goes, don't you forget it. And a few years ago, when this was back maybe 7, 8 years ago, a few years ago when I got ordained, same church, he said to me that morning before I left the house, because I left a little before him, he said, tell me again, who is Jesus? What was Jesus? And I said, a rebel. And he goes, don't you forget it. The other comment I'm going to remember about him long after he's gone one day, and I mentioned this on my blog the other night. I'm a little bit like, if you're familiar with Phil Shepard at the U Catastrophe, I'm known for, I can cuss pretty good, actually. I try not to, but I'm good at it after 20 years of cooking. And one day my dad and I were sitting out in his yard about 6, 7 years ago, watching the sun go down, sitting on a lawn chair. See, I'm having a cigarette. He's chewing his tobacco, and we're talking about something, and he says to me, your cussing's getting a lot better. I said, really? And he says, yeah, I'm always afraid you're going to say something in a sermon. You're going to forget where you're at, and you're just going to slip a word. I said, no, that's not going to happen. But I said, Dad, I really, You know, I grew up Pentecostal holiness. You know, cussing is bad. And I said, Dad, I've got to get better on it. And he looks at me, and he takes a long chew on his tobacco, and he says, you know, I believe that everything in the Gospels credited to Jesus really happened. He says, I believe he walked on water. I believe he stilled the storm. He fed 5,000. He raised the dead. He cured lepers. He, all of it. He's, you know, all of it. He goes, but I believe there's one thing, even Jesus Christ, the Son of God, could never do. And I'm like, what's that, Dad? And he says, I don't believe even the Son of God could get 11 professional fishermen and a tax collector to quit cussing. And I laughed so hard. I remember the chair broke, and I'm on the ground just rolling. I mean, you know, the old ROFL, rolling on the floor, ROGL, rolling on the ground laughing. It was probably the best laugh I had that entire year.
Oh, wow.
Because, I mean, I thought he was getting ready to lay down the wisdom of the ages on me, you know, and it was actually a joke, you know. He doesn't cuss. He doesn't cuss. I've heard him drop the F-bomb 2 times in my life. One was when I asked him many years ago. He was in the Army during Vietnam, and I asked him what he thought about the Vietnam War, and that's the first time I heard him say it, referring to the war.
Mm-hmm.
The other time was after his second wife died. Immediately after that, like that afternoon, we were talking, and he dropped it. He's not a – I'm very different from him. He's very quiet, very stoic, and you can tell I'm adopted because we do not come from the same gene pool, you know, at all. I'm a bit talkative now because, one, I'm not so depressed, and, two, I've had 2 big cups of coffee.
Get you going. Awesome.
Yeah.
So then you started this kind of your blog and everything and your journey. Your sense is you want to help other people with your journey, right? Is that the
– I guess you could say that. It's Yeah. I guess the best way to put it, I started this blog actually just as anyone who sort of starts a blog. I'm like, hey, you know, it's cool. Blogs are the end thing. I should have a blog. And I'd actually started one in seminary off Blogspot back, well, that was like 2004. But I was in the middle of summer Hebrew. And, you know, in summer Hebrew is not a good time to start a blog. Summer Hebrew is a good time to sleep and study Hebrew.
Yeah.
I mean, that's it. And so I started it. I think it was called Working Man Preacher, or maybe it's still on there. I have no idea what my password was. I'll never see it again. And I don't think I did anything on it, except if you were to look it up, I think it has the title, and that's probably about it. And I said, well, so much. That was a great experience at blogging, you know, 10 minutes. Now it's time to study Hebrew and look at flashcards. And so then when I got out to Mississippi, the internet really was a big thing to me because not to use labels, but I find myself kind of falling into the, I guess you'd say, the emergent tribe, so to speak. And here I am in rural Mississippi, where I was being compared to a preacher that they had that actually retired 3 years after I was born, and I'm 47 years old. You know, he was buried right behind my backyard. Great guy, Woodrow Bagby. He was an incredible minister. I met people who knew him. When I was having a bad day, I would go out and have a conversation with him, occasionally with an adult beverage in my hand. Unfortunately, Woodrow never gave me any advice because I guess he was busy being in the ground. But he was an incredible guy. But he retired in 1966, or retired from that church, resigned after 20 years. And 1966 was an interesting time in Jones County, Mississippi. To explain where I was at and why blogging and the internet and Twitter was such a link for me, was finding people I could really dialogue with. Not to say I couldn't dialogue with people there. I could. Made some good friendships to the extent that they were like that. But as far as really keeping up, I went to Cornerstone Festival, and I got to meet Tony Jones, Phyllis Tickle, Dr. John Perkins, who anyone out there who's never heard of Dr. And I say he's Dr. Perkins. It's like a friend of mine who's a musician. He says, Mr. Parker, speaking to Charlie Parker. And he said, anybody can play as good as Charlie Parker is a Mr.
Right.
Mr. Parker. Well, that's how Dr. Perkins is to me. I met him. He was involved in the Mendenhall protests, like it was about 1970, was almost beaten to death. Mendenhall is a, well, bigger town than where I was at, but Mendenhall was not far from where I lived, maybe 40 minutes, something like that. It was definitely in that neck of the woods. And I remember driving through Mendenhall to a Presbytery meeting not long after I met him. and thinking about his book, I think it's Let Justice Roll Down, which is his life story up through roughly that period. An incredible and absolutely, I think my thrill of Cornerstone in some respects was I got a photo with him. And I'm not into the photo op thing, but I met Cornel West at a poetry reading in Louisville when I was in seminary, and he got a photo with a friend of mine. I didn't do that. He signed a book of mine, a poetry book I have. To this day, I wish I'd had that photo with Cornel so I could put it on my desk in my office in Mississippi and basically make people who walked in shudder, like, oh my goodness, he's with Cornel West, you know, it's the end of the world. But I got the photo with Dr. Perkins, and it's one from maybe my most favorite photo I have on my computer. But so I went there, and after that, I went on a reading binge. I went to Lifeway, which was our great source for books, Lifeway and Barnes and Nobles there in Hattiesburg, and I spent almost my entire $500 educational fund just getting books and reading and reading and reading. Because, you know, in seminary, you read dead guys mostly. I mean, it's great. I read Tillich, and I read Bart, and I read Bonhoeffer, and I love Bonhoeffer, but you're so busy reading Summer Hebrew and Paul Tillich that the books that are coming out, you have no clue what's going on in the present world, so to speak. So this last year or two, I caught up, got up to speed. But now with this blog, I started it, well, last May, I guess, thereabouts. And if you really want to see what bipolar's like, just go back and look at some of my blog entries over the last year until about 3 weeks ago. They're all over the place. There, one's about Gandhi. One's called I Suck. It was after spending some time with my ex-wife. She's wonderful. I love her. I wish we could work it out. I just want to say that if I ever give out a message that I'm like, you know, in that bitter, oh, she's a bad person. No, not at all. When I drum, her dad was a very famous percussionist back in the day, and I'll be playing drums tonight. And I always think to myself, I wish that she would just walk in the pub and hear me drumming, because it's a big deal between us. But anyways, you know, I had been around her one evening, and just when I left, I was just very distraught. So it's stuff all over the place. And the reason I did this blog, one, was that I write. And my psychiatrist said writing, and my ex-wife said this, she said, writing regularly on your blog is therapeutic for you. It's a focus point. It's something you do, and you need to do it. I'm a lazy writer, and I'm a depressed writer, which means I don't write enough. Also, having just gone through seminary, I was sick of writing because I was tired of writing papers. But you know how that goes. But anyways, so I said, I'm going to do this every day while I'm coming up on my meds, which will be, say, 2 months. So I'm about 25-30% into it now. The other thing is that it gives me a roadmap to look back on so that I can look at some of the early entries compared to, say, what I'm going to write in 2 months. And I can see, so to speak, if I have a bad day down the road, I can see how far I've come. And if in the process this helps people, and it has, you know, one of the things you go through, I guess, with any mental illness, but with bipolar, the first thing you think is everybody else is messed up. That's why you go through a lot of jobs. You don't adjust well to community. You know, it's not that you have a false inflated view of yourself, although you very well may. You know, I've been prone to having the big head in my life. I'll admit it. But nobody wants to think they're off base. No one wants to think they're off kilter. So, you know, it's like, boy, if I wasn't around all these screwed up people, I'd be all right. Then you go and you get diagnosed. Then you find out, oh, wow, my foundation isn't solid. I'm this way one day and this way the other, and I'm not right in the head. And so then you go through a little thing, which is where, like this one woman blogged about, you go out in public to wherever it is, and you feel like the crazy person in the room, you know, because you just discovered your entire paradigm that you're normal has just been thrown under the bus. So now you're like, great, I'm the crazy uncle at the family reunion. I'm that guy. What happened, and also because when you take these drugs, they take time. It's not like taking a Xanax to tranquilize you. It's Prozac takes starting at about 2 weeks to 2 months, and they bring your dosage up. Right now I'm at 10 milligrams. Eventually I'll be at 20, which is actually a fairly low dosage. So it's not like I've said in my blog, I'm impatient. I want these things to work quicker. So you have this period. Here you are. I remember before I was taking my pills every day, and I'm thinking, great, I'm taking my pills now for 2 weeks, and I'm still crazy. Oh, boy, well, this sucks. Another thing I want to add to that that's different when I take them now, you cannot drink and take these pills. And I stress this to anyone. They told me this, and here I was just going through a massive breakup that just shredded my personal world. And I like to drink. I mean, I was in the Army. I was in college. Come on, I like to have a few beers. And when I go to the pub tonight, I like to have about 2, 3, sometimes 4 beers when I'm drumming, one a set. Can't do it because it really affects how the pills work. And they told me this before, but I thought, well, come on, if I want to sit around my campfire with my dog in my backyard in Mississippi on Friday night and have a couple jiggers of Makers on the rocks, that's fine. Once a week or something, or, maybe I want to have a beer, with my burger, or whatever. You can't do that. So I have completely quit drinking this time, and I can feel the difference in the pills, even after 2 weeks. I thought I was getting the full effect before, but I wasn't because, I'd have a few glasses of wine a week, or maybe on Friday night, have a couple of, 16 ounce cans of Bud, and really, all it takes is a beer or two, and it completely changes the effect of them. You're not getting the full worth. And so I'm just putting that out to anybody who takes these that if you're a social drinker, no. If you're a problem drinker, no. If you're a full-blown alcoholic, no. You just can't. And that's just one of the ground rules. But I think it's worth it. It's worth it. Except that when I go drum tonight, it's about the last set. It's a little annoying because not that I wish I had a beer. It's just when you're the sober guy in the bar by 1 a.m. sometimes in a rowdy bar.
Yeah.
You just find some of what's going on completely obnoxious. what's wrong with you guys? Are you guys drunk or something? Yes. Oh, you are. Oh, that's right. We're in a bar.
Yeah, that's
right. Right. I would be with you. Yeah. It's like that. But I mean, that's the thing. I'm hoping it does help people. And what's surprising to me, and I mean this genuinely, is I knew that there might be people that read the blog that had issues, and I don't mean just bipolar. I know people with eating disorders, and I met a woman 2 weeks ago who sat in with us at the club singing. Wonderful singer, incredible blues voice. And without her mentioning it to me, I was talking with her later, and I noticed she was a cutter. So, believe me, in my life, I might be one of the most normal people I know. I don't know, but and she's a wonderful girl, and we're developing a good friendship now. Because she really is. She has a negative view of herself. It was funny when I met her though, because I had mentioned to some people at the club that I knew that I couldn't drink because I was taking these pills, and she was sitting there. Sitting at the bar, and she says, are you one of the open mic musicians? And I said, yeah, I'm getting ready to start playing here in a few minutes. She goes, I heard you say that you're diagnosed bipolar and you're taking Prozac and you can't drink. And I'm like, yeah. And she shakes my hand and she says, my name's so-and-so and I'm actually an affective schizophrenic and I take this, this, and this. And I think it's really glad to meet you. And have you ever heard of Carl Jung? And I'd love to talk about the relationship between Eastern mandalas and Jung's study of, circular drawings by schizophrenics. And a friend of mine looks at me and he says, hey, what's up, Benny? It's like Benny and June. And I'm just like, right, dude, whatever. But she's a great girl. And we did have a great conversation on Carl Jung during the set break, which awesome. Amazed a couple of the other guys that I play with. They're like, who's this Carl Jung guy? What are you talking about? I said, you have to be diagnosed mentally ill to be part of this conversation. And you haven't been diagnosed yet. I know you're nuts, but you haven't been diagnosed yet. So you just go over there and watch TV, and I'll be with you in 10 minutes to play, But honestly, the thing that's when I say it's comforting, I don't know if comforting is the right word, because I feel for anyone who has a problem, but there are people that I know on Twitter, or that I know in real life, that I have viewed, especially in the last year, as being incredible people that just don't seem to have any mental, emotional issues in the world. Like, I wish I was them. You know, they have it, the person who has it together. And I'm finding out from some people, they don't. And they're like, I'm so glad you're writing this. And I can, your honesty helps me to be honest. And it when I say it comforts me, I'm not comforted that they have issues. But it's that comfort in the way of, wow, I'm not alone. You know, it's just like in high school, I was the geeky kid named Eugene, who played clarinet, who was treasurer of the Bible club, who couldn't get a date. Nobody would dance with him at the dance, blah, blah, blah. And I met a lady, well, now, but she and I went to high school together. I was the annoying dweeb who sat next to her in world history in 10th grade. She was a cheerleader. She was on the homecoming court. She was, you know, Miss Thang, big woman on campus. And we ran into each other out at the beach about 5 years ago, got in a conversation. And I told her, I said, you know, I had this crush on you in high school. And she goes, I know you did. You were so annoying about it. I said, yeah, I had this crush on you. And I really wanted to ask you out. But I knew you wouldn't go out with me because, you know, you were Miss Thang. You know, you were president of the student council and whatever. And, you know, I was the big dweeb. And I still am a dweeb. I just grew my hair longer and partied some in between. So, but I'm really a dweeb. And she and I got to talking, and she actually looked at me and said, Gene, you thought my life was so great in high school. And she goes, I'm going to tell you what was going on. And she had a horrible, even though she, economically her parents were very well off, she had this horrible home life. And she almost dropped out of high school, and she had an eating disorder. And basically a lot of what she did as accomplishments in high school, she felt her parents had pushed her into it. You know, you have to be that popular girl. So she couldn't be herself, as she put it. And it was shocking to me that all, after these years, here we are in our early 40s, and we're talking whatever, you know, when we were like 15, 16 in high school. And I'm finding out that this person who I thought was like this goddess who had no problems, had all the friends, had it made, she was having maybe a more miserable existence in high school than I was. What really kicked me off is she told me if I would have asked her out, she might have said yes. And I said, no, you wouldn't have, because I asked you out 3 times. She goes, yeah, but you were obnoxious because you were such a dweeb, you know. But, you know, it made me feel bad for her. Mm-hmm. But when you have a mental illness, you, at least for a while, especially when you're diagnosed, you feel like, boy, there's 6 billion people in the world, and one of them's really screwed up, and he's me. But I guess it's like any disease. You know, my dad has cancer. He's had it before. You know, you whether it's cancer, HIV, diabetes, whatever, you find out you're not the only person with it, and you link up with these other people, and you share, and you laugh together, and you cry together, and you learn about treatments together, and you eat together, and you love together in your community. And that's the other thing I would like to say is find – I don't think there's a bipolar like group here in Ocala that I found. And I've kind of thought down the road of maybe – even if it's just a group of us getting together at the local diner and just, you know, have breakfast. Don't even call it a group. Just, you know, we're just a bunch of people with bipolar hanging out, having coffee and pancakes on Wednesday morning at the diner, you know, whatever. Something like that. And also on the web, I've been discovering – several, you might say information hubs. I'm thinking about posting the links on my blog tonight, for various, kind of like a WebMD, but they're specifically through mental health and bipolar. And also, I've met several individuals on Twitter who also are doing something similar to what I'm doing. And so it's really neat to meet people, and you just find out you're not alone. It's very existential, you know, the old writings of Sartre and Dostoevsky that, You're kind of alone in the universe, and all you got is choices, and you don't know how to make those choices, and those choices you make, that's, you know, it's going to bless you or damn you, and that's it. And when you find out that you have a mental illness and you're kind of living in a little alternate world in your head, finding out that there's other people, that sure is a comforting thing.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's absolutely the thing with depression. I isolate. Yeah. I isolate. Even on my pills, I can do it. If I don't, I was told by someone, I don't care if you have a day off work and you have nothing to do, go out and do something. Go out and do something, because one day in the house can turn into six for me real, real quick. And if I'm not on my medication, I'm not treating my condition, that can be a hellish 6 days.
Right. No kidding.
It can be a very hellish 6 days.
Wow. Well, man, hey, Gene, I do got to run myself, but dude, it was so good talking to you. This stuff is awesome. What's your blog address so that people can follow along a little bit?
Blog? What would it be? www.geneanderson.blogspot.com. G-E-N-E Anderson, all lowercase, one big word. GeneAnderson.blogspot.com.
And I'll put a link up here for you, too.
I'm at RevGene, REV_GENE on Twitter. And I'm on Facebook. And if you come down to Ocala on Tuesday nights and every other Wednesday, I'm playing
drumming,
playing percussion down at O'Malley's Pub on the Square, which I got to tell you, I don't want to sound like a lush, but I got three favorite bars in the world, and I'm going to plug them. Number one is O'Malley's. That's like family. Number two is Jack's Barbecue on Anastasia Island at St. Augustine Beach, which some pools have a tiki bar. Well, this is a bar that has a pool.
There you go.
And great reggae on Sundays. Awesome. Sometimes sit in. And the third one is a place that helped me survive seminary in Louisville called the Long Shot Tavern in Louisville, Kentucky. And also played music there. So now that you probably think I have a tremendous drinking problem because I just closed this interview as a minister by telling you about my three favorite bars in the world, but just remember this. Churches are known as public houses of worship,
mm-hmm.
and bars are known as public houses. So they have a lot in common.
That's right.
And they both serve wine.
Think about it.
Think about that. I, you know, I don't know why I just said that, but that's so it
no,
is.
That's
I,
awesome,
I have no
man.
Idea.
That's awesome. Hey, can we talk with you again in the future?
Hey, yeah, man, no problem. And actually, the next time we talk, you know, you get to do all the talking.
Okay.
I'm actually hoping to get a podcast as soon as I figure out how to do it. I'm a dweeb, but I'm kind of a dumb dweeb when it comes to computers. So
yep.
I would like to learn how to do podcasts so that maybe I could interview some great folks like you and, you know, different folks. And one of the things I like about the internet, and I was explaining this to my new roommate, is the community.
Absolutely.
You know, that it's almost like this little community, and we just talk and share with each other and interview each other and read each other's books and mm-hmm. talk about life, and it's pretty cool.
It's awesome.
It's pretty cool. I really like it.
I always there's always those people who are like, well, that's not real community, real relationship, you know, whatever. I always say whatever.
Well, you know what I say to that, and I've been saying this a lot lately, and I don't want to put anybody on the spot, maybe they wouldn't mind, but I'm going to tell you something. Last night on my blog, I put it was called Together,
mm-hmm.
and basically I've redone my blog role, and I don't want to insult Brian McLaren when I say this, but I said this to a friend of mine who, you know, she has a blog, and I joked with her. I said, you just replaced Brian McLaren on my blog role. What I mean is that there's 27 people on my blog role right now, and maybe there'll be a few more, but these are people that in one way or another, maybe it was a good word, you know, a supportive tweet. Maybe it was $20 when I needed it. Maybe it was someone sent me a pill cutter. When I take my Lamictal, I have to cut the pills into quarters right now while I'm going, stepping up because I'm on the free drugs program, you know. Dude, I had to go to the county crisis center this time to get my pills because I didn't have insurance. I had to go check myself in, you know, to the lunatic asylum, and you don't get the same nice pill sets when you do that, because I guess poor people aren't as valued, perhaps, sadly. And so I had to cut these pills, and this person sent me a pill cutter. And so all these little things, whether they're a word, a prayer, a pill cutter, I wanted to recognize and thank these people. And not one of them, well, one, there's one that I knew in school, a wonderful, I don't want to name her, Lavender Davenport. She was the senior class president 2006 at Louisville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. And she's an incredible rugby player. And I don't remember the name of the hospital, but she's a chaplain at a children's hospital in Chicago. And she is one, well, here's a good preacher compliment. She's one hell of a human being. And she's, her blog's on there, Being With, but she's the only one I've actually met in real life. And but there's some others. I'll name a couple. John Harrison, who's Tragic Pizza. A young lady named Ivy, Unscripted Life. She's the one I said you bumped Brian McLaren. These people, when people say Twitter ain't real, these people saved my life. They say, I'm not exaggerating. They saved my life. They really, really did. So when people say that, you know, I don't want to mock them, but I just kind of look and I'm like, hey, you know what? Maybe folks that are on Twitter have more of a life than you do, bud.
That's,
you know,
right.
How do you know? And I hope to meet all these people. And I just want to plug the Outlaw Preachers, because a whole lot of them are Outlaw Preachers.
Yep.
And I'm looking forward to being at the next reunion and actually meeting these people. And I got a whole lot of hugs for them, let me tell you.
Awesome.
Because so yeah, when people say Twitter ain't real or the internet ain't real, I don't know, man. It might be a little more real relationship-wise than people give it credit for. And I just say to anyone who's in kind of my position, depressed, whatever, hey, if you can't get out of the house to go down to the coffee shop, or I mean, you know, you're isolating, for God's sakes, man, get on your computer, get on a social network. It ain't the same as pressing the flesh and getting a hug.
Right.
But you know what? It is better than nothing.
It's better than nothing, absolutely, man.
And you'd be surprised what it can lead to.
That's so true.
Yeah.
Well, brother, hey, man, thanks. I appreciate it.
Yeah, let me finish with just one thing.
Okay.
I guess it's become a trademark. I got it from someone a long time ago. You, Cody, and anyone else listening to this, be blessed.
Thank you so much.
Hey, no problem, brother. You take care, all right?
Please remember me when I'm gone. Smile when you think about me singing you this song. And I will look above the clouds into the great mysterious blue and think about you.
Hey, just want to say thanks once again to my guest Gene Anderson for sharing a bit of his journey with us. You can follow along some more at geneanderson.blogspot.com. He puts up some stuff that's open, honest, real, raw, a lot of good stuff, so check him out there. Please leave us some messages. We are becoming at gmail.com. Follow us on Skype, Cody.Stoffer, or on Twitter, at We Are Becoming. Love to hear your stories and how things are working out for you. Thanks for joining us. Remember, life is change. Growth is optional. Choose wisely.
La 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 la. La 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 la. La 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 la. Remember me.